Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, 1770 Euclid Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. This episode is part of All Things Local, where we highlight D.C. history, culture, and communities, Washingtonians who have made an impact on our city. I am your host, Ray Barker, an archivist in the Special Collections Department at MLK Library. And who else is here with me?
My name is Carlos Izureta. I'm with the Mount Pleasant Library Friends, and I'm also a Mount Pleasant resident.
Great. And so Carlos and I are fortunate to be able to speak to someone I have some familiarity with, Kike Aviles. And so Kike is going to talk to us about his life history, his history here in D.C. as an activist, a poet, and performer. So there's a lot to dig through. And I guess I personally like hearing people's lives before they got to D.C. and describing what the circumstances were that led to them being here, where you landed in D.C., an approximate time frame. And where were you born?
Well, I'm originally from El Salvador. And I came here in 1980, directly from El Salvador. So I was 15 years old. And I left my country right at the time when the Civil War was just kind of like breaking out, full-blown war against the dictatorship, the military dictatorship. So I joined a student movement. And they had us on a list, the death squads. So my family got wind of this. So my family basically kidnapped me and took me out of the country. So they took me to Guatemala. And then my papers were already in process at the embassy because my mom has been here since 1969. So I came here legally, but that was the same time when a lot of people were just leaving the country in droves. And most of my friends that I went to junior high school with and high school, had come here illegally. And I think that this is one of the best kept secrets in the United States, that this is the Washington metropolitan area is the only region in all of the United States where the majority of the Latino population is Salvadorian. And it's because of that, because we arrived in between the 80s and the 90s by the thousands and the thousands, and we stayed here.
And were you doing anything activism related at that time? I mean, you were 15 when you left. Were you involved in anything, or did you witness things, or were you involved, or what was that?
Yeah, I was part of a youth organization, a students' organization. So each sector of society in El Salvador had, all their own organizations, the peasants, and the unions, the teachers' unions, university students, high school students. So I was part of this youth revolutionary movement. And we were, we were leftists, and we were considered, communists, traitors of the motherland, subversives, terrorists, all the, good names that are given to freedom fighters nowadays. We were considered those things. The state, came heavily against people. So this was the time when, there would be dead bodies along the side, the streets, and people will be disappear. They will come in the middle of the night in plain clothes and just take you away. And, You know, if family was lucky, your body was found floating in a river, or if it was found, you know, some people just completely disappeared. They were never heard from again.
And then,
so those were the conditions that I was dealing with when I was a kid. But I had developed a sense of consciousness, you know, social consciousness. And, you know, I knew that there was something wrong with the system, and that the poor were poor and the rich were rich, and that the military basically were there to protect the rich. So, and this was nothing that was new to just El Salvador. I mean, all of Latin America was breaking its chains for military dictatorship. So the 60s and the 70s was, you know, those are key decades, you know, for the whole liberation movement all across Latin America. And then in 79, you know, the Sandinistas came to power in Nicaragua. And then when the Reagan administration came into power, you know, they were set on not allowing El Salvador, you know, not allowing the same thing that happened in Nicaragua to happen in El Salvador. So, you know, millions and millions and millions of U.S. dollars were spent in propping up the military regime. And the war did not end officially until 1992.
Okay. And I was curious to know, when you got to D.C., did that spirit of activism or consciousness develop or alter, or how was that carried with you when you got here? I mean, we're kind of leading into, you use some of the subject matter for your performances and your poetry and stuff, so, but was that spirit of activism or awareness implemented in D.C.?
Yeah, there was a large solidarity movement that had already been here, because there was a lot of Chileans and Argentinians that had fled, you know, their countries in the 70s. So there was like a cadre of artists, you know, a lot of muralists, a lot of musicians, a lot of painters. The whole Nicaragua thing had given birth to this whole solidarity movement. So there was already, you know, a solidarity movement with the people of Nicaragua. And a lot of kind of the Latin American struggles, you know, and here in Adams Morgan, this kind of like, you know, Adams Morgan, Columbia Heights was kind of like the hub for a lot of these leftists that will gather at these community centers. And, you know, there were a lot of marches, a lot of, you know, demonstrations. And I just happened to join a street theater group, you know, just as soon as I came in. And that's how I came into theater.
Are you a late teenager, or can you recall what age you're
at? I was 15.
Oh, you started at 15 that early. Wow. Great. And so...
Yeah, so I got started from the get-go.
And there was something about, like, as you were talking, I was thinking about what is, you know, what is artistic expression but a way to either respond to something or make a statement. It's a way to create a culture that you're comfortable in. And I guess that happened pretty early on. And were these performances politically motivated, or did they have that?
Yeah. Everything had a message. I mean, everything was about what was taking place there. And then later on, that changed to what was taking place here. So... you know, the realities of immigrants here in the United States and the realities of race. D.C., just because of how segregated D.C. has always been, D.C. public schools didn't really have white people going to public school except for Deal or Wilson. So when we came in by the thousands, they threw us, you know, into Francis, into Roosevelt, Cardozo, you know, and those other schools that had never had another ethnic population in the schools. And just because of our plain ignorance, you know, and kids are kids, and kids love to fight for some reason. So we will fight and call each other names and, you know, racial names, racial slurs. And so this whole dynamic was developed you know, the blacks and against Latinos. And I went to Duke Ellington School of the Arts to study theater, which is the only DC public school here in the district that teaches art. So I was in the theater department, but I was also, you know, realizing that a lot of the parts and a lot of the stuff that they were teaching me, there were no parts for Latinos in this place. And, you know, given the fact that I was living in Adams Morgan and Mount Pleasant and in Columbia Heights and seeing all these fights, so we decided to respond to that. And there was a group of punkers and you know, just teenagers that used to hang out together. And it's the two black girls from Southeast that also went to Ellington, and this other Salvadorian guy that we have met, just hanging out. And we just decided to do something about it. So why don't we do a play? And so this is when breakdancing was coming about. So
I remember that, yeah.
And that's
this is early 80s, huh?
Yeah, so that's kind of like the only time that you will see blacks and Latinos together because of the breaking crews. And you know, everybody thought we were breakers. And I'm like, no, we're actors, we're poets, you know. And the Latin American Youth Center kind of adopted us as a school project, as a project to go into the schools. So fresh out of high school, we got jobs in the community to do theater around the issue of this whole black Latino racial conflicts. And the name of our group was Latinegro, and we were the first group of black and Latino young artists that were writing their own material about what's happening, you know, to the communities.
I had a quick question for you. What music inspired you when you were younger? Any of the Latin American, like, political folk bands?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe some favorites?
You know, I listen to Victor Jara, Quilapayún, Inti Illimani.
Carcas. Los Carcas.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So all those, you know, the... and then when I came here, it's funny because I never considered, I never knew what a Latino was. You know, I'd always been a Salvadorian.
Right.
And all of a sudden I arrived here in my house, my mother, my brother, my sister, you know, all the people around, they would talk about Hispanos, los Hispanos, and los Latinos, and I'm like, what? It's like, what is that? And my brother was like, you fool, us. So all of a sudden, you know, I started realizing that there were people from all over Latin America here. And a lot of people were listening to salsa. And that's when Rubén Blades and Willie Colón were kind of breaking off from the traditional salsa. And they were doing more political stuff, and that's the kind of stuff I started listening to. But at the same time, I was into punk rock, so I used to go to a lot of punk clubs, punk shows, and that was kind of like my life was kind of divided, you know, in like three, four different cultures, you know, because I was also immersed in black culture at Duke Ellington, because the majority. I was the only Latino there the first year in 81. And when I left, I think there were five of us, five Latinos. And there were probably 10 whites. You know, the majority of all the other kids were black. But what was different about Duke Ellington is that we didn't fight. You know, we didn't beef with each other. We were there to get an education in arts, and whether it was dance, whether it was painting, or playing some kind of instrument, singing, or, you know, or acting. So it was a completely different environment. And the school had this very Afrocentric approach to the education. So I learned a lot about jazz. I learned about, you know, black history. I learned a lot about, you know, black artists, you know, black art. So, you know, the school is located in Georgetown, so I would go to Georgetown, and then I would come back over here, you know, to 15th and Urban and Columbia Heights, you know, which is all black. And then it was changing because we were coming in, so we were changing the neighborhood. So now it was Now it was black and brown, you know, with a few whites here and there. Adams Morgan had a little bit. Adams Morgan was known more as a hippie place, so there were a lot of hippie whites, you know, living here in Adams Morgan. And Mount Pleasant always had a lot of white homeowners as well. So there was always a mix of people, but 16th Street was kind of like the border, because whites will stay on their side and blacks and Latinos will stay on their side.
Right.
And we were talking about that first acting group that, or the performance group that you had, and you would go into different high schools. Was there a sense of teaching people how to get along despite racial differences? Was that the message?
Well, that was one of them. That was the idea. You know?
And do you feel like that was? Can you determine if that was successful, or how were the performances received by the kids?
Well, the kids used to have a ball because, you know, I mean, the stuff that we would write was very reflective of what they were doing on an everyday basis.
Yeah, so. Kind of realistic, youthful, energetic.
Right, calling you mama, you know, calling people niggers and, like, you know, amigos and, like, you know, why don't you go back to Mexico, you know, it was just so, but it was participatory theater, so. It was this type of theater in Latin America. It's called Teatro Foro, where you stop the action right in the middle of a very dramatic moment, like, so let's say somebody's about to stab somebody.
Yeah, there's a conflict, and it's like...
So you stop, you freeze the action, and then you ask the audience, okay, what should happen now? You know, should she stab him? You know, what happens here? No, the police come. Oh, no, the mother happens to, you know. So you take suggestions from people. You create an ending. And then once you created an ending, you say, okay, so who wants to be the cop? Who wants to be the mother? You know, so the actors would step out and the students would actually become the actors and finish the sketch. And then there will be a discussion.
Right, and so through that activity and through that involvement, ideally the participants gain some insight from that real life example.
Yeah, and it's been, you know, work better than, you know, just say no.
So we were talking a little bit earlier. I'm trying to do this narrative timeline, but I know we have poetry to read, and I brought a book. But can we talk about the sort of development of just your own voice and your single voice and your single one man performance? Somewhere in the early 90s, I guess. Can we talk about that development of you just... I know you would take on different characters and you have different sides to that. Can we talk about a little bit about that? Maybe that show in 92 or whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah, no. So I was with Latinegro until 92. And then I was the director, but I, you know, we were part of the social services agency. So... there was just a lot of paperwork, a lot of, you know, administration stuff. And I never been one to, I'm not happy with pushing papers. So finally, I just, you know, and I had this wanting for many years to do a show of my own, you know, a one-man show. And, but that it was also, you know, I was... you know, learning my chops as a poet, and you know, there was this desire not to write for or with a group, but to just do something on my own. And that was when I first did a show called Latinhood, and I played four different characters. You know, I got to play my mom. I got to play. This guy, Loco Culebra, Crazy Snake. I played this Nicaraguan kid. And then I played this Colombian waiter. There used to be a teacher in Colombia, but now he's living here and being a waiter because, you know, he cannot be a teacher here.
And that's a real person?
Most of my stuff is based on oral history. So, yeah, I do a lot of interview work.
And a mix of English and Spanish?
Yeah, but... you know, after, I guess, yeah, mixed, yeah, for the first show was very bilingual, but then from then on, I mostly wrote in English.
Yeah, and I was just going to ask, so that first that title that you mentioned, that first one, is these are about 15, 20 minutes long? What it's like?
No.
They're longer.
They're 1 hour shows.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Right.
So I'm on stage by myself for 1 hour.
Yeah, that's. I get tired thinking about that. The energy to keep up across four different characters with four different, you know.
Yeah. Is one more thing.
Are
the shows very physical too?
They tend to be, and you know, and then so it was a mixture of, you know, some. I mean, it's changed over the years, and I've gotten heavier, chunkier. So I used to be really skinny, and you know, I used to be a really good dancer. So, yeah, I was incorporated, you know, some kind of physicality into it. Now I get winded very easy. So I play all chubby characters now.
The characters age as you do. But we're talking to Kike Viles. I was going to ask move on a little bit, but I first saw Kike perform at Rhizome at a thing I was doing back in October last year. But B. Stanley put me in touch with you through DC Arts Center, which is down the street, and I know you've done some performances there. So you've been performing around the city since the 80s? Yes. These different theaters, is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a, you know, it's always been whoever's called on me, I've mostly been there. So, when I first started doing street theater, of course, everything was done outside. You know, we did performances in front of the White House, the Pentagon, the Organization of American States, you know, the different embassies.
And you did some out here, you were telling us, out in front of the church.
Right where we are, Columbia Road. And I've been working with B. Stanley for, B. Stanley and I probably known each other for 20 years. And he's directed, I think the last one will be our 12th show that he's directed. So my hub has always been, you know, Gala Hispanic Theater, DC Arts Center, and the streets of Mount Pleasant.
Yeah. So, and I meant to say that part of the performance you did, and that was my introduction to you, was the video footage captured of the Mount Pleasant riots in 1991. And can you talk us through that performance? And we can get into what you brought here, something to read, and I have the book that I purchased from you. But what about that particular performance? It was really moving, and you know. But do you want to talk through that?
Well, see, most of my projects tend to be collaborations, right? So the images that you saw, those were black and white images of the riots that were taken by Rick Reinhardt, who is also a very well-known photographer here. And him and Nancy Shear, perhaps.
He's a Mount Pleasant guy or
Adams
he's, Morgan?
Yeah, he's from Mount Pleasant.
Yeah.
He started in Adams Morgan, but then he, you know, finally settled on Mount Pleasant. He's lived there for forever.
And Nancy Shea, you were saying?
Nancy Shea still lives here in Dance Morgan. And they're the two photographers that I think have the most expansive collection of negatives, you know, of images of the beginning of the Latino community here, dating back to the late 70s or through the 80s, 90s, and to the now. So they've been shooting, you know, our lives, our experiences, our festivals, our events, you know, our riots, our marches, you know. So these two, so in that performance that you saw, that's Rick's work, accompanied by music. And what tends to happen with my work is that I work with musicians, I work with people who do video, it's with sound engineers. So even though they're one-man shows, you know, we counted last show that I just did at Gala Hispanic Theater 2 weeks ago, and we had a team of 14 people working to make a show together. So even though it is just me on stage, it takes a whole team of a support system in order to make him happen.
And what is that? What is on the sheet of paper in front of us? Do you mind me asking? What is that there?
That is part of the script. It's one of the poems from the script from the last show. It's called The Return.
At the Gala Theater?
Yeah.
Do you mind?
It's called the show is called Poetic Chicle, The Return of Loco Culebra. And it's a show that takes place in the now, meaning in the Trump years. So it's the story of a descendant of Quetzalcoatl, Kukulkan, the feather serpent of the Aztecs and the Mayans. And the feather serpent is the union of heaven and earth. So this guy claims to be a descendant of those gods from the past.
An actual god himself then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's part of the world of the spirits. So he comes back from heaven because he sees that Trump has been elected. And he's like, my people need help, man.
I take it this isn't a comedy.
It can be. So this is a piece that I wrote, you know, just thinking when I was doing all the research. Because this is not a, you know, this whole anti-immigrant thing and the whole thing with trying to build this wall. It's not just particular to the United States, you know, it's a global issue. I mean, you have refugees all over the world. So this piece is called Today is Not a Good Day to Be a Darker Shade of White. Today is not a good day to be a darker shade of white. The skies are cloudy. The storm is near. The most unwanted have understood they're not wanted. Praise the North Africans. Praise the Afghanis. Praise the Bangladeshis. Pray for the Syrians. But you are not wanted. Today is not a good day to be a darker shade of white. The checkpoint is closed. Today no crossing will be allowed. Your passport is now declared invalid. I'm sorry, sir. Today is not a good day to be a darker shade of white. Look at the ocean, seas of dead bodies, floating dead dreams. The world is big. The border is near. You go by foot. You go by boat. You bring your daughter. You beat your fears. But today is not a good day to be a darker shade of white. The government has decided hard measures must be taken. Your children will be taken away. Your children will be put in jail. You will go to jail. You will be deported. Your children will be taken away. Just thank God that you're alive today. Because honestly, sir, today you chose the wrong day to be a slightly darker shade of white. Next.
Yeah. That was just a piece from the performance. And they generally are taking this kind of format then, in the form of a poem?
Well, no. My format is that poems are always read. That's my rule. The poems are always on a page. And I must read them because they're poems. I don't memorize poems. So every show that I've done, I've always ended up with a cluster of poems from each show. And sometimes the monologues come first, and the poems come later. Sometimes the poems are born first, and out of the poems, the characters come. So, you know, it all depends on the theme and what I'm trying to... I mean, and to be honest, this is not a show that I wanted to be doing because, you know, it's a show about such an unpleasant person, no? Trump. I don't know if you can even call him a person. But, you know, it's something, I mean, a lot of people that know my work, they were kind of like asking me, hey, dude, you know, when are you going to do something about this guy, right? So, I said, to hell with it, you know, let me just go at it. You know, and I spent probably about a year, you know, trying to develop the material, and I ended up with this 1 hour show. So now we've done it twice, and then we're going to do 4 nights at DC Arts Center the first 2 weeks of June. So Friday, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. right here on 18th Street in Nance Morgan at DC Arts Center.
Can I ask you a little bit about your process for poetry versus writing a monologue? Do you just write all the time, like take notes when you're walking around?
One of the sad things is that I'm losing my ability to write by hand. Something has happened with me and my writing. So I think I have become dyslexic. So I reverse letters, numbers. But sometimes I cannot understand my own notes. So now I type most of all my stuff. But you know, it's a very lonely process. So all the poems I write on my own, by myself. The monologues, in the last few years, I have an assistant who, you know, we create an outline, and then I just kind of start throwing things just to see what attaches to the wall. Mm-hmm. And I literally... I do cut and paste. So from my notebooks, I type on my notes, I print them, and then I cut with scissors, and then with tape, I put them on the wall, and then I start moving things around and see, okay, this fits with this other piece, this fits here, this fits there. And that's how, so it's kind of like a very tactile process, because I have to feel it, see it.
Yeah. And it's kind of physical, too.
Physical, yeah. So, and a lot of times I have to be standing in front of the text in order to be able to interpret it. So, you know, you go from draft after draft after draft. I think this piece, we must have done, 15 drafts until finally we said, okay. And we're not even, it's not quite done yet, so it's still some more work to be done. But we felt that we had enough to present it the way that we had it. So, you know, we're going to make some changes between now and June, and then it'll be a final version.
And that's the Friday and Saturday at DC Arts Center down the street, I guess June 7th and 8th and 14th and 15th.
Correct.
Et cetera, through the month. But is that? Do you mind telling me? I mean, if anybody wants to know more, they would go to the show, obviously. But is it? Do you feel like the characters and the storyline and that story arc is definitely a direct result of Trump being in office? Is that the main thread?
Yeah, it's the story of a Salvadorian kid who leaves El Salvador in 1996, and then he gets stuck in Mexico. And then finally he makes it here. So it's 3 decades in the life of this guy, Chamba. So you see him as a kid, then you see him as a 17-year-old, and then you see him as a 27-year-old. And when you see him here, the first time that he speaks, so the other two monologues are in Spanish, one in very Salvadorian accent, the other one in a very Mexican accent. And the one... here, it's a very, you know, kind of like streetwise English accent.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he's only on his way to the post office to send his citizenship application. So he's married a white woman and has gotten his papers, has a daughter that was born here, so she's an American. And he questions, you know, the journey that he's been through, but his mother also is about to be deported. So it's a kind of like irony there. And the show actually starts with the voice of Trump and his followers you know, yelling, you know, all that stuff that they yell, you know. And it's the build a wall, build a wall, build a wall, build a wall, build a wall. It's just kind of sickening to listen to that at the beginning of the show and to think that there is actually, that he has millions of followers and that there is a chance, you know, that he will be reelected. So that is the unfortunate part of the show, it's a piece of the time, and I'm kind of crossing my fingers that I will not be stuck with this character for another 6 years.
And Kike, I was going to ask really quickly that you talked a little bit about your hesitancy to do a piece about Trump, and I was curious, was it because why spend so much time on something or someone that you have such unpleasant feelings for and about? Was it that, or was it something else?
Yeah, but it's also, I think, you know, as an artist, right, as an artist of conscience, you know, because I decided not to be an entertainer, you know. I'm not the type of artist that's going to come and do a song and dance for you just so you can clap and feel good about yourself. There has to be some level of reflection that you walk away with,
In some discomfort.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of, you know, white liberals that came to see the show, you know, said very, very specifically, because we had a discussion after each show. He said, you know, you've thrown a lot at us, you know? I said, but that's my role, no? So I think that there's a certain level of responsibility that comes with being here for so long. I mean, I'm, you know, going on 40 years, and, you know, I'm not necessarily crazy about being on stage, you know, dealing with such, sad matters, you know, ugly matters. But it is what we have in our hands, and I think that it is our responsibility to deal with them and to try to figure out, okay, so what's my role in this? What do I do as an individual in order to make the change that's necessary so that this does not keep on happening, so that the children are not put in cages, you know, that people are not treated at a subhuman level, that people are being denied, you know, shelter, food, security. So, you know, those are the questions that I think that are posed by the performance itself. But those are the questions that I had to pose myself as a human being. You know, what's my role in this?
So if we go to the performance at DC Arts Center, had seen you perform at the Gala Theater, we're kind of coming near the end here. But I was just thinking as you were speaking, you know, some people go to entertainment to escape reality and to get some relief from the sort of ugly and unpleasant emotions and feelings and activities and events that are going on a daily basis here currently. That's one scenario, is to go to the theater and go to a movie screening or go to a live music performance to sort of escape and celebrate something pleasant and joyous. But in this instance, if I'm understanding correctly, it's more about, I guess I'm curious to know what you would expect people to think about or to leave with. Is it that recognition of I am an individual and I have the ability to try to engage myself in the bigger picture and try to implement change? Is that sort of a main takeaway for someone who would just show up at the DC Arts Center or at the Gala Theater?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the hope, is that you have some kind of impact, no? That you, even as unpleasant as the theme is, right? But there's a story. There's a lot of humor in the show, so you do get to laugh, you know. So you do get to relax for a bit. So, you know, it has a back and forth kind of, you know. But that's also the role of the actor and the performer, no, to take you on a journey. That ebbs, no? That it goes up, it goes down, you know, 1 minute you can be crying, the next thing, you know, you're laughing your ass off. And I think that the show has its moments as well. And there's a lot of percussion in it. It's a lot of Latin percussion in the show. Mm-hmm. It's very loud.
Yeah, for a great purpose. And the title again was what?
It's Poetic Chicle. So it's poetic chewing gum. Because the guy, that the story of the kid, he sells chewing gum in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. So it's poetic chewing gum. The return of Loco Culebra. The return of Crazy Snake.
Nice. Did you have any other questions, or was there anything else to read? Otherwise, we can close it out.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to comment and saying, like, art, I think, is really important. It should move you in some sort of way, mm-hmm. whether it's negative or positive, or make you, like, even think about things. Right. Like, and I think that's amazing what you're doing, because I think it's making people think. I mean, they came to you after the show. They're like, oh, you're throwing a lot at us. But mm-hmm. it's something that they have to process.
Right.
You know, they can't just ignore things. So,
and I've always said,
you doing that.
I always said that if I haven't pissed anybody off, then I'm not doing my
right,
job.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, is it largely a Latino audience coming, or is it mixed?
No,
it's all over?
My audience is
right.
I've never played that card. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay,
I mean,
good.
Anyone that knows me in this city knows that, you know, most of my audiences are some of the most diverse audiences
yeah.
in this city.
Was there anything else we wanted to plug? Or otherwise, thanks again for coming.
No, thank you for
I don't know what it is. I mean, do you feel that way, Carlos? I feel like I could sit and listen. I definitely feel like I'm in, like, storytelling mode, and I'm sitting here listening. I mean, did you have that?
Yeah, definitely. I enjoyed listening to all the stories. Your background's amazing. It's really interesting.
Well, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Okay. Right. And I hope you're feeling better soon. I have a couple of plugs here for Special Collections. The Saturday at Cleveland Park Library at 1 p.m., we're going to have a printmaking program here with Amy Hughes. It's on the basics of art conservation, paper conservation. We'll talk about that. On Wednesday, March 27th, are the printmakers. The event is full, but you can go to washingtoniana.eventbrite.com to be put on the wait list. Two more things here. Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m., Saving Personal Treasures. It's a archives advice sort of workshop for folks to dig through their drawers and cabinets and garages and attics to find those photographs and implement preservation tactics with those. And Tuesday, May 7th at 8 p.m., Suns Cinema in Mount Pleasant is hosting another home movie day where users are submitting digitized video to screen in front of their friends and strangers. Please submit by April 23rd and send those cat videos if you have them. Let's see here. One more thing. If you're interested in DC history, go to dclibrary.org/right of the city or go to Mount Pleasant, Shaw, Brookland, Anacostia libraries to see these mini exhibits about those topics. There's a film about gentrification called Dogs, Parks, and Coffee Shops. That's a great title, actually. And add yoga studios. What else? What else is there?
Could be a bunch of things.
What was that?
I said luxury condos.
Luxury condos.
That in?
It's going to be screened for the Q&A from the director at 2 p.m. at Mount Pleasant Library. I didn't know that. So that'll be great. Right. That's coming up. So thank you again, Kike. It's been fun.
Thanks,
Carlos.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to an episode of All Things Local on Full Service Radio. We were broadcasting live from the Line Hotel here in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library services. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter and at DC Public Library on Instagram. You can download the show wherever you listen to your podcast by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you and have a great day, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.